Good morning, good afternoon. Please go ahead. This call is now being recorded.
Thank you, Francesca. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 17th of March, 2015. On the call today, we have Alex Deakin, Holly Raich, Steve Metellus, Val Sherman, Tatiana Krumstova, James Bladell, Todd Williams, Chris Telling, Graham Bunton, Justin Macy, Sarah Wild, Karen Mellotrenouval, Kathy Kleiman, Paul McGrady, Griffin Barnett, Volker Greeman, Osvaldo Nueva, Harry Stummy, Susan Prosser, Darcy Southwell, and Phil Corwin. I show apologies from Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, Dick Leaning, McKaylee Nyland, and Don Blumenthal. From staff, we have Mary Wong and Danielle Andela, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Steve.
Thank you very much. This is Steve Metellus. I drew the short straw this week to chair this call. So I assume Graham will be back in this saddle next week. So we've got a fairly good turnout. And let me just start the call by asking if anyone has any updates to their statement of interest that they wish to share with the group. Okay, hearing none, we'll continue our discussion on Category F, the disclosure standards, and a fairly extensive revision was circulated by Kathy yesterday afternoon. So unless people have another way that they wish to proceed, I would suggest that we just ask Kathy to walk through the document and point out the main changes that she is proposing, and then we can discuss those and see where we are. So, Kathy, are you?
Can you hear me, Steve?
I can hear you.
Terrific. Well, thank you for the invitation, and hopefully not extensive changes, but ones. I mean, we really haven't had the chance to go through kind of line by line and talk about edits. So the big thing that we'll talk about, and it doesn't come till Section 3, is really kind of a standard for the reveal and trying to create a balanced standard for revealing under cases of clear-cut infringement. So maybe we can kind of – do you want to start with that or go through line by line, wherever you'd like to start?
I'm happy to do it either way. I'll leave it up to you how you wish to proceed. If you want, I think people have control of the document in the Adobe. So if you want to start,
actually, let me just start by going through it, and then when we get to some of the big stuff, it will be as always section 3.
Okay.
Okay. So in Section 1, the service provider intake for requests. Recommendation for Roman numeral small 6, that nothing prevents the service providers from sharing information among each other if a requester has been revoked or blocked. I think that makes sense because then, if there's a bad actor in one place, others will be on notice, and it will save time, I think, as providers work through this process.
Let me just interrupt you for a second here.
Sure.
Folks, other folks on the call, if you have questions or comments, feel free to raise your hand, or if you're not in the Adobe room, speak up. We won't necessarily go through the whole document before questions. So when you have a question, you can raise it. And I'll just ask, Kathy, I see you made some changes also to take out the reference to illustrative example of disclosure standards. Could you explain? I think this was originally proposed as one example of how a certain kind of request would be processed. So,
but aren't these the disclosure standards for intellectual property requests? It may be an illustrative example of disclosure standards, but it seems to me this is the standard that we're setting for intellectual property requests. Am I missing something there?
No, I think that's right. It's just that it's an illustrative example in the universe of all requests, but
So maybe there's a way to better phrase that, but it seemed to me it left open that this may be an example for intellectual property, where here I think we're really trying to nail down the world of intellectual property requests.
I see James has his hand up, so James, go ahead.
Hello?
James?
Okay. I was, for some reason, when I came off mute, there was a lot of background noise on my end. Yes, James speaking for the transcript. Thank you. And sorry to take us on a bit of a tangent here, but I don't see the change you're discussing right now where you say Kathy removed illustrative example, because I remember, I think it was my intervention that put that in. So I would like to understand this change, and I don't see it. Can you help me out where that's located?
I think it's in the top line, top sentence.
Line.
And
oh, okay. Oh, the title.
The title, yeah.
Thank you. I was hoping for a section number, but I see it now. Okay, thank you.
Well, James, let me ask, are we missing something? Is this an illustrative example of intellectual property requests or an illustrative example of disclosure standards?
So,
sorry, wordsmithing first thing in the morning.
Yeah, and I'm racking my brain a little bit on why we put that in there. I think that there was a concern that we were backing either reporters or providers into too small a corner, and so we were essentially just emphasizing that this was an example standard, and that the providers would build their policies around this standard. Somebody bail me out here. I'm talking, but the brain's disconnected. Thanks.
This is Steve. I think Kathy's correct that this is intended as an illustrative example of the kind of standards that would apply for intellectual property requests, but recognizing that there are a lot of other types of requests that could be made, we weren't trying to deal with all of those. So I don't know that we need to resolve this wordsmithing question right now. I'm not sure there's a substantive disagreement.
So,
Kathy, why don't you go ahead? I think you've just talked about Romanet 6.
You know what? Let's jump to Roman numeral 3, because that's really where we've been this whole time. I think that's maybe where people's heads are. Service provider action on request. According to my navigation of the document on the screen, it's page 6. And right up at the top, Roman numeral 3, service provider action on request. Does everybody have it?
Yeah.
Great. Thanks. Whoever answered, thanks. So, okay, so in A, we hadn't filled in a number of calendar days that the customer has the opportunity to respond to the service provider. We've discussed different time frames, and so we kind of put out the call, non-commercial stakeholders group put out the call to some of the public interest groups in the U.S. and in Canada that do work with responses on reveals and other situations like some of the copyright takedowns and reveals that we've been talking about. And they said 30 calendar days is the standard, and knowing that we always want to work faster than the rest of the world, put in 15. I don't think that'll be enough in August for people in Paris, but it's more than 7 days, which had been discussed. And so it seems reasonable. That would give people time to kind of get the query, process it, consult an attorney if they need to respond. And so, anyway, that's a proposal that's out there. Going down to B, those edits aren't mine.
If there are any comments on that, people feel free to raise your hands in the chat or just speak up. Go ahead. Go ahead, Kathy. Continue.
Oh, okay, sorry. I guess we should just, Steve, maybe. Do you know whose edits are in blue? Are those staff edits? Are those edits that we've talked about?
Yeah, these are. Let me just get my.
Because maybe it's worth us going back and forth and kind of reviewing the full set of edits as we go through.
No, I mean, I think these are ones that were in there before.
Steve and Kathy, this is Mary. These blue edits were, I think, in last week's version, and they were the staff attempts to capture discussions from the week previous.
makes sense.
I don't see any blue edits in 3A. Are you referring to, I mean, well, maybe my color scheme is different here, but I think Mary's correct that the ones that are not from you, Kathy, are Mary's edits trying to reflect the discussion in previous weeks.
Okay, terrific. And B, no proposed edits. So down to C. Disclosure can be reasonably refused for reasons consistent with the policy stated here and including, I wasn't sure what for example but not limited to meant, so I crossed out one, but if they mean something different, that's just a proposal. Really what counts here is C2. There were three different choices, and before we put it out for public comment, I thought that we as a working group should decide what the choice is, you know, which choice we wanted. So, again, we're talking about disclosure cannot be reasonably refused for reasons consistent with the general policy stated herein. Number two, that the customer has objected to the disclosure and has provided, and the choices are substantive, detailed, or adequate reasons against disclosure. And so I wasn't sure if the option was available to choose because it looks like those are choices. So I would like to propose we choose adequate reasons against disclosure. And I know that will be discussed.
Mary, can you help us out here? Because I know the original language was compelling. And yes. How did we get to these other options?
Hi, Steve. Hi, Kathy. Hello, everybody. This is Mary from staff. That's exactly right, Steve, because as I recall, I think it was 2 weeks ago, there was some discussion around the use of the word compelling. So in the edit that we sent, I think it was last week, not just in Section C here, but further above, the part that we just covered, we did take out the word compelling, and in the former section, we basically said the customer has to give reasons, and then here, as Kathy noted, we offered a couple of options to see if there was a need to have at least some indication of what the type or the extent of those reasons ought to be. So none of these were any thing that was agreed to. It was simply our attempt to try to avoid the word compelling, but to try to provide some sort of possibility for discussion.
Okay, I mean, this obviously begs the question of any of these adjectives, you know, this is, at this point in the process, it is the provider's decision as to whether the reasons that were given by the customer are compelling, substantive, detailed, or adequate. So I'm not sure what the significance is until we know what the standard really is supposed to be, which I guess you're probably getting to, Kathy. But Holly has her hand up, so Holly, please go ahead.
Yeah, it's just a preference for either compelling or something that says this is not just reasons, but actually compelling or substantive reasons. Adequate sort of doesn't get there for me because it's when we're talking about situations where we're revealing someone's personal details, we want to be really very clear in our minds that, in fact, we're talking about the reasons that that would allow that sort of reveal. And adequate, I think there's I think it's an American term, slam dunk reasons. I think that would translate more into compelling or substantive reasons, not adequate. That's just my feeling. Thanks.
Holly, just as a point of order here or information, this is about the reasons the customers gives not to disclose. We already have in two what the requester has to put forward, the prima facie case that they have to put forward. So that's already spelled out there. And this is on the other side of it at this point.
Well,
and it's a provider's decision as to whether to put it forward.
Aren't we actually sort of saying, well, in both cases there ought to be really good reasons?
Yeah, maybe. But all I'm saying is that what has to be put forward on the requester side is kind of spelled out in part two of the document.
Yep. Let's see what
other comments on this C2 or other views about how that should read. Well, go ahead, Kathy. Why don't you move on to C3?
Great, thanks, Steve. So this is adding something that we've talked about and seemed to be in general agreement. So I thought I'd add that the provider has found fill-in-the-blank adequate reasons against disclosure. And this is the default situation we've been talking about. The customer doesn't respond, and yet it's Paris, and it's August, and it's a battered women's shelter. So the provider can look independently, and this is, again, something we've talked about that didn't appear to be any objections. So just elaborating that the provider has the right, not the obligation, to look independently and see if there's something, some situation that would mitigate against reveal, even if the customer hasn't responded. Thanks.
Okay. We have a queue of people wishing to comment on this. So Kieran, Val, and James. Kieran, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a little slow this morning. I actually just wanted to make a very brief comment about the use of compelling versus the use of the adequate. I think that I would prefer for us to use language that shies away from a subjective element as much as possible. I think that compelling seems to have a more of a subjective element than the word adequate. I think that adequate means that it fulfills a certain criterion, which we spelled out here, herein, whereas compelling gives more, in my opinion, discretion for the provider to say this isn't good enough or that's not good enough, and that's kind of what we're trying to eliminate in this document, in my opinion, is, you know, the ability of these kind of, you know, fringe and rogue registrars to kind of use any excuse to deny the request. So that's my 2 cents on that. I'm sorry for going back, but yeah, it's even earlier here than it is for James. So thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Kieran. Val, go ahead.
Hi, this is Val. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. So my comment is on C3, and I apologize. I may be a little bit confused, but is this the proper place to put, you know, I have to be honest, maybe it's my cultural ignorance, but I had to Google what happens in August in Paris before this meeting. Is this a proper place for this note as far as disclosure being reasonably refused for this particular reason? Perhaps, you know, arguably, this is when a provider may need some additional time, and this, you know, we can discuss that, you know, perhaps under B3. But I understand the intent is that the provider may act on its own information and research if the customer doesn't respond, and that's, you know, that's reasonable to an extent. But some of these situations, I think the note is what confuses me, and I wanted to know if maybe Kathy can clarify how this fits into reasonable refusal. Thank you.
Steve, may I? It's a great question. The note is not intended for the final text. I just wasn't sure if, you know, comments and the comment bubble would get reflected in, you know, the Adobe system. So the note is just intended to be kind of an example.
Okay.
You know, we can also do, you know, the month of December. So thanks.
I'm a little uncomfortable with the suggestion that we've agreed that August and December in Paris intellectual property rights are suspended.
Let's delete the note. We can do it right now. Maybe Mary could do that. Just take out that old thing.
I think the point that Val was making also is that we sort of have something to deal with this, which is B3, if there's some reason for delay. But in any case, James, let's go ahead with you.
Hi, thanks to you, James speaking. So I think, yes, dropping the note is probably a good idea from C3. I just had another suggestion for C3, and it's really, I hope it's not wordsmithing, because I think it does contextually make more sense if we invert that sentence. So instead of saying that the provider has found adequate reasons against disclosure, we would say something along the line, the provider has not found adequate reasons for disclosure. And I think that's in keeping with understanding the with the, you know, supporting the sentence that's laid out in C, which is, you know, why a disclosure can be reasonably refused. If we want to keep it the way that it is, then I would say instead of reasons against disclosure, I would say reasons for refusing to disclose. I don't think it reads very well, that's all. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, James. Val, is that a new hand or an old hand? I guess my concern with your suggestion, James, and then we can move on from this, is that, you know, the whole point of Section 2 was to say, here's what you need to put forward to get disclosure. And if obviously it's not automatic, but I think it's fair to have some expectation that if you put forward all that information that is requested, and Kathy's added some additional information there, which we'll come back to, or proposed adding that, then, you know, you're in the game. So we to say that there isn't adequate reason for disclosure, well, we've given you what you asked us for in number two. I guess maybe you could say that the request doesn't fulfill the requirements of Section 2. That might be one way to deal with it. But otherwise, I'm a little concerned about that shift that you've suggested. The other question, of course, is, again, well, maybe we'll get to this about what reasons would be considered adequate. So let's see. Do people have other comments on C3, or should we move on to, I guess, the next substantive changes in C5? Okay, C5. Kathy?
Okay, thanks. So this is, let me just read this. This is kind of, this may be a compromise between creating a complex case type of advisory group or some other kind of group. This is being presented kind of as a middle ground. So number 5, which is at the top of page 7 on the document on the screen, requester shall understand and honor the standard that PTSI reveal will be limited to, quote, slam dunk, close quote, cases of obvious clear-cut infringement in which the requester presents an obvious clear-cut case of trademark or copyright infringement and in which the customer does not provide or the provider is unable to find a clear or reasonable defense to the use of the trademark or copyright, including but not limited to, and here this is a list basically from the URS, that the customer is commonly known by the name, such as the last name, the customer is using the domain and or trademark mark before the requester's trademark existed, the customer is making or using, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, using the copyrighted material or trademark for fair use, fair dealing, parody, and or tribute sites, and or education, research, and advertising using competitors' names in countries where such conduct is illegal. Sure, there'll be a lot of words and changes offered, but the concept is the slammed up case of clear-cut infringement without a really good defense.
Okay. thank you. Let's see. I see Todd has his hand up, and if anybody else wants to comment, either put your hand up or speak up if you're not in Adobe. Go ahead, Todd.
Thanks. Todd Williams for the transcript. And Kathy, you may have already answered the question I was going to ask. You used the phrase middle ground. I was a little confused when these came in because this draft and the draft from staff that included the detailed language on the complex case advisory group came in kind of around the same time, and I wasn't sure if we were supposed to view these as mutually exclusive. My guess is the answer to that is yes, because presumably if the standard is slam dunk, there would not be any cases to send to the complex case advisory group. It would be an empty set, and I think that was what you were hinting at when you prefaced the comments, but I didn't know if there was any further explanation on that.
Steve, may I?
Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
Todd, it's an excellent point, and I don't want to speak for all the people on the call. I mean, this is something we really need to discuss. But last week when the complex case advisory group was presented, there was a lot of concern about it. So, Todd, you're right. This is envisioned as an either-or. And if you have a slam dunk case, then you probably don't need the advisory board. That's what I'm thinking. But others who have thought about this, you know, for the whole week may have other views. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. I see Kieran's hand is up. Kieran, go ahead.
Hi. I'm really kind of uncomfortable with this whole paragraph, and I think it's not necessarily the obvious clear-cut cases issue, but rather this kind of attempt to boil down, like, trademark law in general, I guess, into this paragraph. I think that I understand that you have the language here, including but not limited to, but it's just, it seems like there's an attempt to put some fairly, you know, complex and nuanced concepts into this agreement in a way that limits, kind of, I guess, limits the rights of the requester and kind of expands the rights of those, you know, attempting to make a fair use argument. I don't know what the solution is, I think, for this, but I certainly don't want this to be the language in here. So I think I preferred the more kind of open language that we originally had around this issue. I guess I'm curious to see what the other IP folks on the call think, but it just seems a little like we're attempting to encapsulate a very, very large concept into a very small paragraph here.
Okay. Kathy, did you want to respond?
Yeah. If you're uncomfortable with everything after including but not limited to, that it was more illustrative than other things. But here what we have is a situation where the registrant side, the customer side, is very concerned about these complex cases, and, you know, which we've talked about as fringe cases or minority cases, which from a speech and expression perspective are very, very important. And so putting something in is very important for a number of us, and so we've been experimenting with different ways to do it, and this one seems to work. But if it would make you more comfortable to cross out kind of the illustrative examples, anything after including but not limited to, unless others had objection, that would be fine.
Yeah, so I think that would probably be a good start. I think also I would not use the phrase slam dunk, to be honest with you. I would look like, maybe I would say something that made it a little less, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. Would it be possible maybe to go and look at something else that we've done, like when we developed the language for the URS, to see if there's, you know, a somewhat, okay, so Mary put in the chat probably what I'm struggling to say. It's a culturally difficult term. It's also, and I don't agree with Stephanie's comment about irrefutable, because I don't think that's what we're aiming at either. I think we're going for, what's the standard you're at? Clear and convincing evidence. And so I get what we're trying to do here, and I get that we don't want to turn privacy proxy providers into, you know, people that are making determinations on nuances in the law. But the whole language of this paragraph, including the part that you said you would take out, which is great, is just a little bit too tilted in the wrong direction to me. It's not as clear, it's not as easy, it's not as usable. And I think that we have good examples of language that we've developed around this same concept, and I think maybe we should look at that and try to put that language in as opposed to this language as it reads now. Thanks.
Okay, James?
Hi, Steve. James speaking, and to Mary's point, I think slam dunk needs to come out, and that we should probably, wherever possible, mirror the language that was used and is in effect for URS, since that was essentially what was front of mind when I think we were trying to hammer out this compromise between what the providers have to do and what the registrants, what sort of protections the registrants are seeking. So I think that I think that's a good that paints us a roadmap in the right direction. And if we can take a look at URS and say what standards have been established there, and can we mirror that language where appropriate? Thanks.
Okay, so there seems to be interest in looking at the URS. I think slam dunk will not, or slam duck will not be used. But I guess, again, I'm just looking at this, and I see two standards. One is obvious clear-cut infringement, and then this is obvious clear-cut case of trademark or copyright infringement. So I'm assuming those are the same thing, basically.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're saying, Kathy, that the provider should look and say, is this an obvious clear-cut case based on what was submitted under Part 2? And then, the provider has told the customer, and the customer has come back with something. Is that a clear or reasonable defense? That's question two. And then question three is, even if the customer doesn't come back with anything, you're suggesting the provider should look and decide whether there's a clear or reasonable defense.
The providers may look, and maybe we need that authority.
Yeah, yeah.
May look and see. Again, the classic example is a battered women's shelter.
Well, I don't think that's classic of anything, because that's not about whether there's a clear-cut case of infringement or whether there's a reasonable defense. That's about the character of the registrant or of the customer. So I'm not sure that that's really relevant here, but I just think that we need to... I think Kieran had mentioned earlier, if we can make these standards as objective as possible, and maybe and there's a limit to what we can do with that, I'm sure, but I just would focus on these phrases, obvious, clear cut on one side, clear or reasonable defense on the other side, and see if we can, if ask people to think about whether those are the right phrases, or, again, maybe whether we can borrow something from URS that is... more useful here. I will just point out that URS, of course, only covers a subset of the kinds of cases we're talking about here. But in terms of the level of evidence, perhaps we can borrow from that. So,
and for what it's worth, that's what we were working on over the weekend, was URS type standard.
Right.
That's where the term slam dunk comes from. Even though it's not embedded in there, that was kind of what we were talking about in the early days of the URS. So yes,
I think
the
you
concept
mentioned that in your earlier post too. Yeah.
Right, so the concept being embodied. Thanks.
Okay, let me just see if there's any other comments at this point on C5. There's clearly some more thinking and work to be done on this. If not, can we move on to, in D, I think you just added lack of in a few places. Lack of was originally there in one place. We added it in two other places, and you put it in two more. So
exactly, so that it's lack of UDRP, lack of URS. You know, if anything else is going on, we stay out and provide.
That's fine. Okay.
Cool.
And of course, that remains in brackets. Then we have E.
Steve, sorry, this is Mary. I think Val had her hand up, and I did
sorry.
As well.
I apologize. I'm trying to multitask here and not successfully. So Val, please go ahead, and then Mary.
Hi, this is Val Sherman again. I'm sorry. I don't mean to backtrack, but I wanted to make a point about C5, and perhaps I'm reading something into it that isn't really there, but I'm a little bit, I'm wondering what the terms shall understand and honor the standard of these, slam dunk, obvious, clear-cut infringement cases. I'm just, I guess, because we still have yet to talk about, sanctions and potential information sharing and blacklists of providers who've engaged in misconduct, I just want to make sure that this is not kind of going there. What is clear cut might be, I don't want to say debatable, but a provider or a requester that submits a case that may ultimately be refused as perhaps not as clear cut as a requester thought. I hope will not be sanctioned. I guess I'm just wondering if we can table the discussion of sanctions in that particular terminology till some point of time and not, you know, accept it as agreed to language. I don't know if that was clear or not. I'm just a little bit concerned about the understanding and honoring the standard.
I mean, Kathy, do you have any comment on understand and honor and why that's in there?
I think we can definitely work with the wording.
Yeah, because, again, this is to the requester, and it's not clear. If I were a requester, I'm not sure what I would be supposed to do as a result of this. But, okay. Mary, go ahead. Sorry that I overlooked the hand.
No worries, Steve. Thanks very much. This is Mary from staff again. So I had two comments. I think both have been covered to some extent by Steve and Val, so I'll just make it quick and do as a follow-up. I think in terms of the understand and honor, I think staff looking at it from a drafting perspective were a little concerned that this seems to be placing some sort of affirmative obligation through a non-contractual framework. And so to the extent that Val's suggestion about putting it elsewhere under a more general heading might work better in that respect. Secondly, and this is, I think, related to something Steve said earlier, that in terms of what is a case of obvious, clear-cut IP infringement, just thinking about it from drafting and mirroring, it didn't really seem that it was sort of the exact opposite or reflection of the set of important minority cases we were discussing earlier. There seems to be either some overlap or some gap in there. And so my question, I guess, was to the group that put this forward, as well as to the requesters and providers that worked on the framework. If language like in C5 right now goes forward, then essentially this is the universe of the disclosure request that will be honored. And if that's what's intended, then that's great. We should put it in there. If there is something that's missing or something that's supposed to be broader, then we probably want to reevaluate this language. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Mary. That's a good point. I mean, I think, you know, there's a couple of references in here to what's the general policy and what's the general standard, but we don't actually spell it out. And the question is this it? And if so, is this sufficiently clear and definite on both sides? What's an obvious clear-cut infringement? What's a clear or reasonable defense? How would you establish those things? I think those are good questions to think about in terms of how this would be phrased. Unless there is other comments on C5, and we've already been through D, could we, Kathy, do you want to move on to F and explain your proposed edits there?
Sure, but just a note regarding C5 that this is probably the right section for this because we're talking about disclosure and when disclosure can be reasonably refused. So whatever the final wording, this is the right place for it, probably not someplace else. Okay, so D was lack of.
I think F was your next edits. Mistaken.
Okay, this is about making sure. Well, this is about something we really haven't discussed, and I think we need to, which is the annex. And the annex is where the appeals are. Or the arbitration, the right to go to a third party for a review of the provider's decision. And so this is a much longer discussion, and we really haven't got to the annex, but certainly before we close Category F, we really should, and talk about what are the standards for an appeal, for lack of a better word. We may call it something else later. Do we want to draft it so that there's a high standard, a high threshold for appeal, or a low threshold for appeal? Can everybody appeal, or can only certain special cases appeal? Do we defer largely to the provider's discretion or not? Sorry, lots and lots of open questions. The purpose here was to make it as accessible, whatever standard we create, high or low, to make that appellate process as accessible to customers as it is to requesters. But, again, I think this is a big open issue. Thanks.
Let me just make one clarification on this. The annex actually is not about appeals. The annex is about a method for dealing with disputes when there's been a disclosure based on a false statement. And this was very important to some of the providers, which is why it's in there, that we have some way of dealing with that problem. The appeals thing, I think, is what you see in F is, and the footnote is what was, that's about it in the framework as far as appeals go. So just to clarify, those are two somewhat different things. One takes place after disclosure has occurred, and someone claims that it was based on false pretenses, if you will. The other is it within the process of deciding whether disclosure will occur, I guess is the way to put it. So they're two separate things. I guess the other question I would have about customer appeals is how that affects the timeline, because, again, the timeline here, and whether it's 15 days or whatever we come up with, it kind of marches through, and after 15 days, unless there's been an extension in an unusual case, you would know whether you would get disclosure or not. But if there's going to be a customer appeal, then presumably there has to be some method for telling the customer we're going to disclose, and does the customer get a second bite at the apple if it hasn't responded the first time? These are just questions that would have to be addressed, I think, about the appeal process.
Steve, can I ask a question? And maybe I misread, but isn't it drafted now that the requester who gets turned down has a right of appeal?
Yes, that's how it's drafted.
Each and every case.
Well, first there's a reconsideration, and then there's basically just asking the provider to relook at it, and then as it's drafted, and this was bracketed, that there would be this ICANN approved review process.
Okay.
That's how the framework was drafted. I'm just raising some issues that if we went to a system in which both sides can appeal, we would have to incorporate that into the timeline and so forth. Okay, let me see if there are any other comments on F. Okay, so two things in F. One is that the appeal would be from both sides. The second, that there would be some threshold. Appeals could only go in exceptional cases.
That's the proposal.
That's the proposal. Okay. Todd?
Thanks. My question is on the second of those two points, the exceptional case threshold. I don't quite follow how that would be implemented. Obviously, the party that wants to appeal files the appeal to the dispute resolution provider, and the provider then either reviews it or doesn't. I don't quite follow where in that the exceptional case threshold gets fleshed out, unless we're assuming that the provider has some sort of bifurcated process where they first do a quick look and then go do a more full look. I guess I don't quite follow that.
Steve, should I respond?
Yeah, Kathy, sure, feel free.
Okay, sorry, this isn't a very good response, Todd, but can I recommend that we set up a Tuesday meeting to really talk about the annex, which seems to have many open sections and many, it seems to be an open process on all sides. And so that, we can put this language on hold for right now pending what happens with the annex. But I think kind of the one-page annex is really a set of notes on an appeals process that hasn't been fleshed out on its standards on anything.
The annex is not about appeals. It says some options for resolving disputes arising from alleged false statements leading to improper disclosures. So it's a different process. I think your appeals question is separate. But if you're suggesting that we have a call that's focused on appeals, that you know, that may make sense to do that, but it's just not the same thing as the annex.
Wait, but
the annex is there. I mean,
Steve, any controversy?
I can help out on this, but this is for a situation where there's been a disclosure. It's too late to appeal. It's been a disclosure.
Yes.
And then the provider has some concern that the statements that were made under penalty of perjury that led to the disclosure were false. That was the concern that motivated this.
That is definitely one of the paragraphs of the annex, but there's another one. Any controversy, claim, or dispute arising between the service provider and the requester shall be referred to and finally determined by a dispute.
Well, but it says as a result of alleged wrongful disclosure of the customer's contact information. I think you took that out, but that's I'm just describing how the annex read before you changed it. So you took out as a result of alleged wrongful disclosure of customer's contact information.
I think we really do need to talk about this annex because it has I think it deserves its own discussion then.
On the question of
who has access to it, when they have access to it.
False statements leading to improper disclosures.
On what was originally intended.
Okay. Well,
because those of us who weren't involved in the drafting appear to have some real questions about when it's available, how it's available, who it's available to.
Okay. Well, I'll ask. I don't know Volker or others who were involved in this. James, you feel free to weigh in. But that, I'm just saying that this is not the same thing as appeals. But appeals is really dealt with very in the framework. It's dealt with it pretty tersely, and it may well need a lot more discussion. Okay. Let me just see in terms of the time here to see if we can get through this. Can we turn to 3, unless there's other comments on 3F, can we turn to 3G?
Sure, very important. So 3G, and also, again, the appeals, okay, so the appeals are more embedded in the text of this itself, so interesting. So the annex and the appeals are both things to talk about in future meetings. Thank you for pointing that out. Okay, so 3G. Nothing in this proposal shall prohibit a provider from determining the customer's use of the service, may violate its terms of service, and reveal the underlying information, despite the criteria of this proposal not being met. I think this is an addition that very much reflects what's earlier in, let's see if I can go back to...
In 1C?
1C. And Volker, I hate to put you on the spot, mate. Can I ask you to speak to this? Go for it to say no.
Apologies, I had to take an urgent call, so I'm not quite up to speed where we are right now.
I think that we're talking about 3G, Volker, in Kathy's red line, and how this differs from 1C in the original framework.
Nothing in this proposal shall prohibit a provider from determining the customer's use of the service, may violate its terms of service, and reveal the underlying information, despite the criteria of this proposal not being met. So this is very much still the discretion is with the provider.
We were discussing offline the criteria that have been met, and I was just concerned that in the draft that we've been discussing and going over, this point was lost. So I wanted to raise that. I didn't have the entire paper in front of me. So if that has already been covered, if this is a duplication, then of course it can be removed at this stage. I just wanted to clarify that it's the provider's prerogative. It should remain the provider's prerogative as it is now, that if a domain name registration violates its terms of service, then, of course, it would be able to take action even if the threshold level of the complaint has not been met. If he makes an independent determination that his terms would be violated, then that would also be a reason for a disclosure. So I just didn't want to have the disclosure limited to only cases that are brought by complainants, but also give the provider a prerogative to say, this is not something that we support, this is something that violates our terms of services, this is something that we will not stand for with our name.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Volker. I guess I would just ask people to look at 3G and 1C and see if they seem somewhat duplicative to me, but maybe there is some something that maybe they could be combined, or maybe there is some need to have both. So let me just ask folks to look at that. Okay, can we go back to 2, where you've made some changes in the templates as well, or you suggested some changes, and we've skipped over that because we wanted to get to 3, which is kind of the meat of the meal, but can you just briefly, because we are coming near the end, Kathy, do you have any comments you want to make on 2, in particular, I guess, 2A3? I think this is pretty much in all of the templates, so maybe you could spell out where.
Right, and thanks for the opportunity again for this whole discussion today. So 2A3 raises the concern that the person filing may or may not be the trademark owner themselves. So that if it is a representative, you know, how do you identify them? So the communication may be through a lawyer, but under the circumstances, it makes sense to know who the trademark owner or the copyright owner is, especially as there may be different jurisdictions in place. So it may be a U.S. company with a European lawyer or an Asian lawyer. So we hadn't really talked about that provision of if someone else is filing on behalf of the intellectual property owner. And so in both the template A3 or B3 in other cases, as well as the very, very bottom, that last line of each template, you know, clearly identifying who the signatory is, because, you know, somebody is making a big statement here under, you know, penalty of perjury, if we choose to go with that high standard, that there is an infringement action. It would be good to know who they are. Thanks.
Okay, let me see if there are any comments or questions on that. It's not that clear to me why the nationality of the lawyer makes a difference, but maybe I'm missing something here. Okay, so those are the changes. I mean, you've got that, I think, in all of all three of the templates, including the copyright one.
Right. So trademark needs to be changed to copyright. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we'll just ask folks to take a look at that. Okay, so have we now gone through, now what comes next is this draft language on disclosure and human rights, and I think we were talking about, or there was some reference that this is an alternative way, but that if your language that had been the slam dunk language were in there, I guess I'm trying to understand what the significance or the where we are on this draft language on disclosure and human rights, which was circulated during the week. We obviously should talk about it, unless people think it's become moot as a result of Kathy's proposal. Kathy, is that your sense or not?
Well, the proposals haven't been accepted yet, so I think we're still kind of wrestling with the question of difficult cases. And so there are now various alternatives on the table for how to solve that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay, so I'll open, I mean, we just have a couple of minutes remaining, but we can certainly open it to comments. So this is the language that I think Mary circulated a couple of days ago, and we'll ask for if people have comments at this point on that. Todd and Stephanie.
I'll go real quick. This just gets to the question I was asking earlier. If this is an either-or, as Kathy outlined, my recommendation would be to focus on getting 3C5 to a point where, you know, there is consensus, which it feels like we're not that far away from and feels like a relatively discrete issue as opposed to diving into this, which seems much more substantive, but that would just be my suggestion.
Okay. Thanks, Todd. Stephanie, go ahead.
Thanks very much, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. I think there have already been raised some good arguments about why this concept could be problematic. On the other hand, I think there's a widespread belief in civil society that ICANN doesn't have enough knowledge and expertise available on human rights and privacy issues. So that while we have a tremendous amount of expertise in copyright and trademark law among the stakeholders that are present, there's much less on the other side, with all due respect to everybody present on this working group. And in particular, these are the knowledgeable folks that come to ICANN. We're trying to set rules for folks outside ICANN that might be just counting the dollars and figuring they'll just abandon their customers at the drop of a hat. So even if we don't keep this concept, I'd just like to put on the table that some sort of notion of a human rights impact assessment is useful when you're deciding on these difficult cases. Don't know how to implement it as an instrument. Don't want ICANN getting into content issues. But there is a kind of a vacuum there that we might want to ponder. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. Let me see if does anybody else have comments on this this draft language document? This is Steve. I just had one that I think was reflected in the chat earlier on. I think Kieran mentioned this. I mean, these examples, are examples of registrants or customers, if you will. They're not necessarily examples of the use they're making of the domain name. So we do need to take into account the situation in which someone asserts that they are, you know, they fall within these illustrative examples, but the use that they're making doesn't necessarily have anything to do with that or may involve some widespread illegal activities. So I just think if we do go down this route, we need to incorporate that that perspective as well. I think we also talked last week about the human rights perspective on the other side, particularly in the copyright area, where there's a human rights globally recognized human rights interest in material benefits of exploiting a work of which you're the author. So, you know, if we do go down this route, and at this point it's not clear to me that we will, I just think those are a couple of factors that we might want to take into account. Okay, let's see if there's any last comments that people want to make. We have identified, and some of these are reflected in Mary's notes, a number of areas where we need some further discussion. There's been a suggestion that we have a session focusing on appeals, and perhaps on as well on the annex for dealing with remedies for improper disclosure. There's been suggestions that we look at the URS, for example, as one source of finding some language that perhaps is less a little more objective or clearer than what we have on the table now in terms of the standard. But I think this has been a useful discussion, and appreciate everybody's participation. And thanks particularly to Kathy, who was on the spot for most of the call, walking through these revisions. And I would call them extensive, but I think they were also valuable. And I think we now have a little better understanding of it and can proceed from there. So with that, we're past time, and I will thank everybody for their participation.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Bye, all.
Francesca, if you can please stop the recording. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.